Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Highly Inspired. I'm Ella.
And I'm Jordan.
Hey, guys. Welcome back this week. We just have a few announcements before getting into this week's topic, which is the fake American dream. We do have our Kickstarter, which is live. We're about halfway through it, both with the funding and with the length of it. So just go ahead and check out our video if you haven't already, and our page, and kind of just read about the project. We also just had a new shipment of journals that came in. If you haven't seen these already, these are our inspired journals. And they have our little motto right there, and we either have blank or lined. So whatever your preference is, those are available on our website, and they're also available via the Kickstarter with some of our reward programs. So feel free to check that out. But yeah, let's dive into this topic. So I think the American dream means a lot of different things to different people, but I think historically what it's meant, just across the board, is creating your own self-sufficient life with little to no third-party intervention. And I think the main way that people see doing this was owning your own land. And the reason behind kind of so much expansion into the United States originally and then into the western part of our country was just everyone taking advantage of all the opportunities to establish themselves, especially through things like the Homestead Act and the Oklahoma Land Rush. But I think over the past century and a half, that foundation of that dream to create a space to live freely has kind of turned into us being trapped in this hamster wheel of corporate America and that machine, and not really having any time left for ourselves or our families.
No, you're right in saying that the American dream means a lot of different things, and it's used all across the board. We've had it attributed to the concept of America since day one. But I think that what we want to do in this episode today is just sort of walk you guys as a listener through the timeline of, you know, how this nature of corporate America has shifted the understanding of the American dream, like that saying, the intrinsic meaning of the saying. Because when our founding fathers created America, they cared about spiritual well-being. They cared about social and economic well-being. And that American dream included the well-being of all of those things. But there was a massive shift that even started in the 1900s towards the well-being, you know, of everybody in like a rich sense, more going towards like a monetary emphasis. And so now I feel like that has definitely stayed throughout all these years. And right now it's probably at the peak of that, where we are pursuing this American dream of being monetarily and fiscally rich at the cost of being, you know, socially and spiritually poor. And I think that that's a discussion that's worth having. And so that's what we want to do today. There's a lot of things going on in the world right now, obviously, since we talk about the pandemic a lot. That has shifted some things in corporate America, in the work-life balance, in the 9-to-5. So we want to talk about those things too. But what are your first thoughts of, like, did the phrase the American dream ever have an effect on you? Like, do you have any, like, relationship with that prior to us, like, coming to this topic idea right now?
Yeah, I think what I didn't even think about kind of the fact that we've traded in the financial, I think you said it really well, we've traded in the financial well-being for our kind of spiritual and, like, personal freedoms. I think that's the perfect way to say it. And I think for me, I did, prior to this topic and prior to really like diving into this and kind of seeing the flaws in the American, not in the American dream that we originally talked about, but what has now kind of been presented as like this fake American dream. Mm-hmm. I really did like buy into that growing up. I think that you see this kind of suburbia model where, you know, you have kind of your traditional house and, you know, you're owning your house, and it gets bigger and bigger as time goes on, and you're making more and more money at your job, and you're putting more and more hours, and your title gets fancier and fancier. And with that, your cars get nicer, and kind of you just accumulate more stuff. And then you know, you need to obviously have, you need to be smart with your money. You know, you can't just take travel whenever you want. You might only have like 2 weeks of travel. You know, once you have kids, you have to save money for them to go to college, and then they have to repeat the same thing that you're doing, you know, and with the hopes of like, okay, you're giving them a better life. And I think that for a while, that idea did motivate people to work hard, like contribute to the system, like not be lazy, etc. But I think that with inflation, with our system kind of turning its back on working people, with the middle class disappearing, this model doesn't even work anymore. And it's turning into, okay, people are waiting, you know, they get out of college, they're $200,000 in debt a lot of times. They can't even buy a house until their 30s, if not that. I mean, we were just talking to a woman who, I mean, her daughter grew up in a very privileged, nice area here in Phoenix, and now she's living with her husband in California, and like they can't even afford a house there. They can only have one car. And it's not like they're uneducated or not hardworking, or they aren't like in the system. Like they are in the system. The system just isn't paying off, you know?
They've taken and completed all the steps that normal, you know, life path tells you
to do,
and that will guarantee you certain luxuries, but really they don't even have that many luxuries. They have the bare minimum.
Yeah.
They cannot save their money out there because all of it is going towards the cost of living and ultimately taxes too.
Yeah.
So,
and
is that financial freedom?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. And then you throw in, okay, well, obviously having a family is part of that American dream. At least that's how it was presented to me growing up. I don't know if it was to you, but that is a big part of it. Like, I think you said something really important to me the other day. Like, what is the point of doing everything that we do if it isn't for the next generation, and ultimately the kids that you have, your own biology, like continuing on to the next generation? Like, at the end of the day, that's why we do everything that we do. That's why we are responsible with our money. That's why we save. That's why we work.
It's about legacy.
Yeah. And
that's not a selfish legacy as in, you know, your own personal legacy. That's the legacy that you leave so that other people who are younger than you remember you as, or, you know, just the environment, how you left the environment when you're no longer here.
Yeah. And that's something that people can't even get to do nowadays. You know, like if they're in debt, they can't buy a house. They can't even think to afford kids. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they want to have kids, they're ready or maybe can afford it. It's either too late, or even just to have the child is really expensive. You're maybe too old. Maybe you have to freeze your eggs, maybe you have to do IVF. Like, these things are really expensive and they're not covered by insurance or stuff like that. So it does feel like we're kind of in this loop of just producing, and we're not even producing for ourselves anymore. And that doesn't feel very American to me.
Yeah, we're just kind of producing for the sake of producing to have some sort of monetary gain so that we can just exist with the bare minimum.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There's just not much flexibility. There's not much range of ways that you can maximize it. And if you don't hit the bare minimum, then you're like not acceptable in society.
Yeah.
So there's kind of like one option and that's it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, that's why a lot of people feel stuck, I think.
Do you think that there needs to be a total kind of revolution of this concept, or do you think we need to go back in history to like the roots of what the true American dream are, or do you think we just need a full, or do you think we just kind of need an edit of this like current model that already exists?
I like the word edit.
Yeah.
I think an edit, I would like to bring more awareness to what, you know, the foundational, you know, concept of what the American dream at that time was, just so that we can have more of a current understanding of it so that that can help us start to reimagine and reinvent according to our new circumstances now. I feel like that would be a doable and modern approach that isn't too traditional, mm-hmm. I guess. Because, yeah, we live in a different time. We live in a different world of resources. And the country, land-wise, in a physical sense, is in a totally different predicament than what it was in the beginning. Like, talk about real estate, for example. Every, you know, founding father person who moved over here in the 1700s, they most of the time had like their own land. Like everyone had a very large, you know, plot of land to choose from. There, no one had ever been here before on such a mass scale like that. So there was so much to pick from and choose from and establish on. Now it's a lot more developed. So, and we've got companies like BlackRock and Blackstone buying up all the land. So I don't know if we can do that in that sense. Yeah. And everything's so much more expensive. Yeah. So there are certain circumstances that are different. What do you think of that so far?
Yeah, well, I think, I don't know, something that actually just came to my head was, just as like a disclosure, like this episode, like we're not going to get into like the conflicts between, like people coming to North America and like Native Americans. Cause I actually think we should like just
leave it
like that's like a whole nother discussion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like that is a whole debate in and of itself, but I think that just from kind of like just like from America's founding, like what you said, I think that when you think of the reasons why people came here, a lot of it was escaping like religious oppression in Europe. You know, England, there was a lot of like the Catholics versus the Protestants. So depending on where you lived, you might be oppressed in that specific country. If you lived in England, if you're a Catholic, true, you'd be oppressed, vice versa. Ireland, evangelical, etc. There were smaller groups that came here. So like that was like a huge reason why people came to America specifically. And then there was also just the idea of wanting to have your own land. A lot of people that came here were super adventurous and were open to exploring and were risk takers. I mean, if you think about that journey and just like your chances of survival, they're going to be like slim. And so for you to even like put yourself in that position, you know, like you're already taking on a lot of risk and you want to like see the upside. And I think that also there was a lot of people that were seeking economic freedom here and just kind of being able to like not be under the wing of the king all the time, specifically the people from Britain, you know, because they could come here and not have that direct relationship, right? And then you also had people coming here that maybe weren't as wealthy overseas, and now they're coming here and they have a chance to like build more wealth. So already like that's the culture from day one that we were building here. Mm-hmm. And then it got even reinforced more when we decided like we didn't want to be under British rule for a lot less oppressive things kind of than what we're even dealing with now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the taxes that were imposed just from a percentage amount, it was a lot lower than like what we've been faced now with like income tax and stuff. So I think that you kind of had this spirit of like, we're willing to put everything on the line for that spiritual and personal freedom that you talked about. Mm-hmm. And that we don't want to like sacrifice comfort for that. So I think that that has always kind of been the American dream at its core. And obviously, that's going to
risk takers,
you know?
Risk takers, adventurers. Yeah, anyone who's willingly going to risk their life in pursuit of a better life, full knowing what, you know, safety measures were limited to them and what like came with the journey, given like the technology at the time, sailing for 3 months, being in a completely new place that they had never been to before. I mean, it's really admirable, I think.
Yeah.
Like, there's very few things that we as humans can do right now at this very moment, given our technology resources that we have access to, that I think could simulate that same level of, you know, just venturing to an unknown.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think could be a parallel right now? Like going to the moon, going to space?
Maybe,
like, would that
but
be?
Even that, it's like we have photos of it. We know how long it would take. We have a sense of that journey. I mean, even Mars, it's like, okay, yeah, if you were to go to Mars, like, that would be huge. But, like, we still have so much research that we kind of know what you'd be getting yourself into.
Mm-hmm. It's all documented,
yeah,
too.
This wasn't documented. You were going in it fully unaware. I mean, people thought, like, the Earth was flat just, like, a few hundred years before this. So yeah. I think kind of the next stage of it was, you know, the early 1800s with, like, Lewis and Clark and this concept of, like, Western expansion. And you kind of started to have even the differences between the East Coast and the West Coast and kind of what that meant and who were the types of people that would stay in the most more established areas, who would come mm-hmm. west, and
how would the travel caravanning yeah. situation look like? How, like, when people venture to these areas, do they stay there for good? Like, is there back and forth travel? Like, I think that there were a lot of discussions surrounding all of that that entered into the equation just because it was more new.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think was the number one motivator for these people to go, like, out west?
That's a good question. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think it was, like, land. Again, you know, like, farming and stuff like that. And what's interesting,
establishing more territory.
Yeah, and you know, it's people that, you know, they, and the government was starting to, like, incentivize people to go there mm-hmm. and grow food, have a farm, create mm-hmm. like social better impacts, like, for the entire country. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they passed into law things like the Homestead Act of 1862, which was done by President Lincoln, which was kind of right before the Civil War, something like this, where it had been trying to get through Congress multiple times. I think that it had been passed in the Senate 3 times, and then the House of Representatives overturned it. And then when it finally went through Congress on both sides, the president before Lincoln vetoed the bill. So this was something that was super impactful to people, which basically said, if you if you improve and stay on a piece of government land that's 60 acres, and maintain it, improve it, etc., for 5 years, and you can prove that, we will give you the land for free. And pretty much then you could get the deed of title for it. And this
huge
was something
incentive
that a ton of Americans took advantage of. And it basically kind of was a threefold process where you filed an application, improved the land, and then you filed for the deed. And any U.S. citizen or intended citizen could do this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, could you imagine our government doing something like this now?
Mm-mm. No. No, I mean, that's a huge incentive to, you know, maintain the land of this country, like, in a physical sense.
Yeah.
And, like, a massive reward if they cross that threshold after 5 years, which actually is not that long of a time. Like, that's a very doable, tangible, not intimidating amount of time to be, like, maintaining all of that upkeep.
I mean, it is a huge, I mean, when you really think about 160 acres, I mean, that is a huge piece of land, and you have to be ready to, like, farm that, take that on. Obviously, different areas are going to vary. Obviously, I don't have any personal farming experience, so it's a lot harder than it looks. Mm-hmm. But I find it very...
Did it only apply to farmland, or could it have been forest land? Or
I think it was all types of land. But again, this is going to be mainly the Midwest.
Okay,
so a lot of it is
going to
be flat. And if I'm assuming if you're improving on the land, you need to create, like, some sort of economic value there. Mm-hmm. But, like, what was also happening simultaneously is that we were building the railroads across the country at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we were also industrializing the middle of the country as well. And that land was becoming more valuable because the closer you were to the tracks, the more valuable that property is going to be, because then, okay, you're going to have towns and then you're going to have general stores and then there's going to be infrastructure there and people are going to like have, and then the farmers, if
there's transportation, it means people are able to travel throughout the entire country to get to there.
Yeah.
It's not in the middle of nowhere.
And the farmers can get supplies. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a huge part of it. Like if you don't have access to supplies, like how are you going to improve the land? So it kind of took all these things coming together for this to be like a successful thing. But I do just, again, I think that the fact that someone like Abraham Lincoln, who we do kind of veer as one of the more moral presidents, was kind of the guy to finally get this over the hump and implemented. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and it's on the basis of how can we incentivize, given that, I mean, he knew at that time we were in a, like we were clearly in a direction of wanting to maximize profits, understanding that we had like we had so much economic potential, like we were trying to increase our GDP. And so I think that he was trying to set something in place such as that, you know, included those economic incentives, but still were boosting the intrinsic value of like our land here and our, you know, like there's like a very moral basis to it, an ethical basis to it, which I like.
Yeah.
And I feel like we rarely have things pass right now that have that. No, and even if things are sold as like a climate encouragement or an environmental encouragement, like most of the time there's some sort of hidden motive that's supposed to be boosting the potential for a technology advancement that we don't even need. So,
yeah. Well, no, if you think about, I mean, the people that are in charge right now, it's like, okay, you can look and see that most of our lawmakers in DC outperform the S&P 500. To me, that's not very Lincoln of you, where you're trying to create opportunity for people. You're trying to have people build a better life when you're like outpacing the number one way that people do create wealth in this country, which is like a 401k plan, which has to do with the stock market, you know? And so if you have our lawmakers directly in doing insider trading, that to me is like a huge conflict of interest. And like you said, with like the energy stuff right now, I mean, we're seeing that right now where we could be completely energy efficient, independent here, and we're not. We're relying on overseas oil, which is why we're now in this huge crisis with gas being super expensive. And instead of being like, okay, let's solve the problem here, we're hearing from our politicians, just go buy a Tesla. And again, like it's this whole mentality of not catering to the middle class, but still selling this idea of the American dream, and less people get to participate in it. But we're all still doing a ton of work to help grow the corporate state and help grow the marriage between the private and the public sector, as opposed to the public sector being the baseline to support individuals creating their own freedom sectors, you know, which is the exact opposite of what this type of legislation was.
Let's talk about the current state of the energy discussion right now, because I think it's very interesting, and this is going to be around, you know, just as an overall discussion for a while. That incentive of you're going to be helping the planet if you drive a Tesla. Well, how do Teslas just show up in your garage? You know, Teslas have to be manufactured. There's energy that's required, surprise, surprise, to create a Tesla.
Yeah.
Right. So if everyone's driving a Tesla, I don't know if anyone's done the math on this, but if everyone drove a Tesla, hypothetically, we need to find what those numbers are.
And switched right now to driving a Tesla.
Yeah.
To like, manufacture all that.
Would that ROI in like an energy conservation sense outweigh the energy that's required to create this amount of materials for these cars?
Yeah.
Because like they have to be put together, and this is like a very highly advanced technology.
Well, and the batteries take a really long time.
And they're not inevitable, you know, they're not infinite. They're not, they will have issues. They'll break down at some point. I don't know what their lifespan is, but.
Yeah, lithium is really bad for the environment to mine for, essentially. And that doesn't mean that like Teslas are bad or you shouldn't have a Tesla, but there's like a slow process to renewable energy, and things like nuclear energy don't get taken into account. And I think you could even argue that, like, yeah, we aren't using our oil reserves here and our, you know, our drills and everything that, and our rigs and everything that we have set up here. But I think, again, it's more energy wasted to have ships that are carrying that in.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not good for the environment either. So I think that we're just at a state where the people that are making decisions are so detached from the people that live in this country and that just want to be left alone and have their space and be able to just freely work and be connected to the land ultimately, that like they're not serving in these people's interest, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think that also it's a dual thing, because I think that we're, as a population, like, we are voting for these people. They didn't just magically get into office. And
some did.
Some of them did. Some of them, we don't know why they're there. But, you know, like,
they disappeared.
We're very disinterested. We haven't had to be, a lot of people haven't had to be invested in who runs the country, because it doesn't affect them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that this goes back to that lack of prioritizing your spiritual and personal freedom over luxury items or comfort items, even.
Because the separation of powerful elites and resourceful elites that have access to a lot more resources than other people do, you know, normal folk. I feel like that separation being so distinct right now is also another thing that defeats the initial nature of what the American dream was, because it creates like a false, you know, like a demotivation feeling within the subgroup that you can't have control over things because you have to get through this other group first. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when people came over here in the beginning, we didn't have that clear difference. I mean, everyone was on the same economic plane, had the same rights and access to resources. So yeah, I feel like that's a big thing that has changed throughout this overall evolution of America so far and where we're at.
Well, I think there's always been inequity from the start. I mean, from the beginning,
over with more wealth.
Yeah, people are going to come over with more wealth. People are going to be lawyers versus trademen versus indentured servants versus slaves. Like, you're going to have that distinction. Yeah. But I think the difference is that we don't, as a population, we don't value our personal and spiritual freedom. Mm-hmm. We do not. So therefore, we are
and
not.
And we forget that we have that freedom.
Yes. And we forget that that should be the priority over the physical freedoms. And so we have become enslaved to having these quote unquote physical things that we need that are freedoms, like having
quote unquote need.
Yeah. That we need. We need a college education. We need this job. We need this house. And we need to have those things in order to do things that are the most natural things that we do, which is like travel, explore the world, be in nature,
try new things,
grow your own food, like have healthy
create
food,
art.
create art, have a family, like have children, be married. Like, these are things that we say like that we don't value anymore, and they're actually the things that make us like the happiest. Like, when you write, if you write down, most people write down a list of the things that make them the happiest, it's going to be things that are free. Mm-hmm. That's just, that don't cost a lot or don't cost
a lot.
Yeah,
no one's going to put homework. No one's going to put taking tests on that list. No one's going to put,
most people won't even put like my mansion. People are going to put my kids, my dog, the sun, mm-hmm. like a lot of things that make people happy.
Playing a sport.
Yeah.
You know, going to my favorite place.
Painting.
Skiing, snowboard, whatever those activities are. It's different for everybody, of course. But you're right. Yeah, it's not going to be that Chanel purse you got for Christmas or yeah. like whatever materialistic item you might like. It's not. I mean, it's a level one happiness. Yeah. Materialism is level one happiness for a reason. And that's not a religious, you know, a religious teaching. That's an understanding of happiness from like, I actually do believe in those levels of happiness. I believe that level one is materialism. I believe level two is the more accomplishment, say success oriented, achievement based, like mm-hmm. credibility based pursuits. And then level three is, I think giving of yourself, like in a philanthropic sense to yeah. others. I think that those are typically above materialism and accomplishment. And then there's a level four, and that's where it can get into a religious category. But for people who would perceive it in a non-religious sense, it could be just something bigger than yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's interesting, like looking at those, and I believe that our subconscious brain knows that and has always known that.
Yeah, well, and even in like your basic AP psych class, you're going to learn that material things only make up 10% of your happiness. The majority of it's going to be your genetic disposition, then the second largest category is your environment. So like this is very scientifically proven, yet we still focus so much of our energy on like the material things, and things that haven't been necessities for years and years and years, how now all of a sudden become necessities, and the things that were so so inventive of freedom, this concept of owning your own land, that before no one really got to do that, even in Europe. I mean, you were there was the whole system of serfs and lords where you lived on the land and you could get food, but you never owned the land, and there was nothing you could do to like get yourself out of that rut. So this idea that you can have your own space, both like physically and mentally, from other interventions, is a very like freeing concept. And then I think that really the Industrial Revolution is kind of what you know, it freed us in some ways, because it created all of these inventions that were super revolutionary, and they made our lives so yeah. much more comfortable, and we could do so much more.
Comfort and convenience.
Yeah, and we could do so much more, and everyone became richer mm-hmm. Because capitalism does that. Capitalism, you know, when it's not corrupted, it creates more wealth and more things for people. But on the flip side, it slowly started us like focusing on like the wrong things, and then thinking that all these things were essential and basic human rights that aren't really human rights.
Would you say then the Industrial Revolution was probably the biggest catalyst for that shift?
I think towards, it was the start of it.
Towards the more richer aspect of the American dream?
Yeah, I think it was the start of it. I think that it really started going into full throttle like post World War II, because I think that was when the suburban lifestyle caught up with Industrial Revolution and the American dream that like we see on a postcard, where you know, the dad works 9 to 5, he comes home, he's with, you know, the family, has the car, the dog, the kids.
Yeah, dinner's ready on the table.
The kids start to go, you know, college starts to become more of a thing. But now, like, that's accelerated into, like, the whole point that model was created was to prioritize family time, Sundays, you know, any sort of, like, spiritual or religious well-being. Like that whole model was to serve that lifestyle. But like you said, it's now become the reverse as we've had to start putting in more time to the office. Now both parents have to work to maintain that type of lifestyle. Now houses are all super expensive because BlackRock.
It's split up families physically for pretty much 80% of the year.
Yeah.
If you calculate all those hours and add them up in a week.
Someone else is educating your kids, which for a while the schools were fine, but now, I mean, a lot of public schools and even private schools are just either they just don't educate your kids at all, or what they're teaching them isn't in line with your beliefs. Mm-hmm. Best case scenario, what they're teaching them isn't in line with your beliefs. Worst case scenario, they don't know how to read. Like, that's where we're at, you know? And no one knows how to homeschool. No one has the capacity to homeschool because they have to have – women have to work full-time at these jobs in order to pay. And a lot of people, like, aren't, like, you know, the family structure is so different than it was then. And there's so many more, like, workers now. And it's just everything's very imbalanced. And there's a lot more time and people that is required to, like, keep this – machine going, you know? So yeah, I think that was kind of the start of it. And we started outsourcing things like education to institutions. You know, even like think about smaller schools pre-World War II or pre-Industrial Revolution. I mean, it was like a very intimate setting. Like, you had a very small school and you were taught like the basics. So even if you weren't teaching your kid directly, you still knew what was going on, and it was still very like controlled,
hands-on and intimate. Yeah. I feel like intimate's a good word.
Or even that. Think about medicine. Like, think about how different medicine was with like herbal treatments and vitamins.
People
and
made
stuff.
Mostly made their own medicine, especially if you had like a ranch or a farm and made crops and herbs. Like,
you had a
in
lot
your
more
home.
Knowledge.
Yeah, you just knew how to do it, and it actually is budget friendly, not having to, i.e., outsource and buy everything externally. You can just make it.
Yeah, and what was happening during the Industrial Revolution with the Rockefellers, who really were the people behind Big Pharma and funding this, is that there were kind of two pathways. We were looking into solving a lot of health problems through Eastern homeopathic ways, with more discoveries on vitamin deficiencies, supplements, all this stuff that now people are super into. Or there was kind of this pathway towards Big Pharma, what you call Western medicine, the pill and surgery model. And Rockefeller, being one of the biggest beneficiaries of the Industrial Revolution, he dumped all of his money into that second form of medicine and basically made the other one obsolete.
He basically created the entire pharmaceutical industry.
Exactly.
From day one.
And so that's a huge industry where, like we said, you're outsourcing familial knowledge that is freeing and allows you to make decisions and allows you to have that knowledge to third parties. And then if that goes so many generations, you're going to get to where we were in college, where we just were taking antibiotics blindly because we didn't know how to fix our sinus problems. Mm-hmm. We didn't know how to fix our infections. Mm-hmm. We had no concept on how to do that.
All we had been told our entire childhoods and even our parents in some instances was trust
the doctor.
Doctors, like a doctor's a doctor. They've done however many years of school, you know, they're smarter than you. They've taken harder tests than you. They've maybe performed surgeries. Have you ever done that? No. Yeah. So you should trust them. Like, they've experienced more. They've learned more. Like, these are all just hidden connotations that are behind that, you know, that phrase, trust your doctors. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, when it came down to it, we're hearing like all this information that we have access to is from all of these different chains of sources. Yeah. What's better than what the early Americans had, where they made medicine and exchanged those firsthand, you know, results or symptoms or, you know, knowledge mm-hmm. on how it works.
Yeah.
Like from a family member.
Yeah.
Like that's like super intimate, like made it in house. Like this is what you do, not do. This is how you take it. These are the treatment methods. Like we don't have that anymore because no one makes their own stuff.
Yeah.
No one even knows how to do that. Or some people do, but yeah. it's not flying around the mainstream mm-hmm. media sphere like we talk about antibiotics and vaccines yeah. and all of these things that are synthetic and God knows where they're made.
Exactly. And our reproductive health is another thing that gets just passed on. Like a lot of
brushed under the rug too.
A lot of parents don't want to sit down and like have the talk with their kids. Or if they do, all they say is like, okay, like you're 14 now, like go on the birth control pill. Like that's it. Like they don't want to like take the time to really talk about how like serious like sex is, like what your sexuality is. And that mm-hmm. gets, if best case scenario, parent takes kid to doctor to go on birth control. Worst case scenario, no discussion whatsoever. And they're just learning sex ed at school. Mm-hmm. That's like what our mm-hmm. standard is now for reproductive health education and family education. And I think
that's a prime example of how education fails it when it's lectured, you know, yeah. lectured based, like, oh, you've crossed this age threshold. That means you should do this. And it's kind of, you know, super solidified and there's like no room for any nuance. Yeah. I don't think that that's a good way for kids to learn. I think that you present young people mm-hmm. with a set of information, a set of facts, and sort of allow them, you have to allow them to have room for their opinions or else no generation that's younger than us is going to find holes in it to make things better.
Yeah.
If it's just passed down, this is it. This is the best it could get. This is the way to do it. And it repeats every single generation. We go nowhere. We don't go up. Like, yeah. like what if a younger, super healthy brain that is presented with all the facts that I can give them, mm-hmm. what if they figure out something that I have never thought of before yeah. and they figure out a way to make it infinitely better than I could have?
And now you have an open conversation.
That's a legacy that yeah. I want to leave and mm-hmm. that I want all adults to, you know, consider wanting to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree. And I think that even just like, I don't know, like the birthing process even, the fact that now 93% of women don't have a natural birth, that's a huge percentage.
93?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So like that means like some sort of medical intervention.
No epidural.
Yeah, like so only 7% don't do like any sort of medication or anything like that. And it's great that we have, you know, C-sections and this type of stuff as an option in an emergency, but we're one of the highest developed countries with infant mother mortality right now. So it's like, okay, if this works so well, like why is this so high? Why are so many births lead to all these interventions? Why is postpartum so high? You know, it just doesn't feel like I didn't know a lot about the birth process until I started like researching it. You know, it's something that you like think about. Mm-hmm. You think that, oh, like you just get pregnant and then you give birth and then you're done. But like there's actually so much optionality and intricacies in it. And there's so yeah. much like to learn. And like it's just this,
it's been
like
created
richness and learning. And yeah. how can you be expected to learn about this process that's so
complex
and vital to us like going on for the next generation when you have to work like you're maxed out all the time and your time is going to these places that don't even directly benefit you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that conversation about birthing, I mean, it's been sort of created as this is like sold to us as this big bad wolf. Like you just don't like talk about it or consider it until you cross that road, like cross that road when you get there, yeah, type thing, which is probably why it's not like a casual, trivial, mundane, everyday
convo
that, yeah, you have with people. So I think that's probably why. But I mean, it's not the big bad wolf. And maybe if we didn't pan it, you know, present that and propagandize that to so many young girls, it wouldn't seem like something that's so hard to learn about.
Yeah.
And we would know where to go to learn about it. And we would, yeah, know what to trust and what, you know, and help find those holes so that we can help lower these, you know, outlier case scenarios that result in like serious health problems, because we don't want anybody to go through that.
Yeah. What do you think the relationship between like time and money is?
Okay, so I was thinking about this yesterday. Obviously, with the American dream, I think the initial conception of it having the spirituality and social, you know, factors at a top priority, that was the first focus. And then obviously there was like time and money. There were economic considerations that were involved in that too. But I think right now we live in a society through capitalism and all the amazing things that capitalism has allowed us to do to develop this country. We now have like a totally twisted, like, I guess, I don't think that we talk about time enough, but we are always talking about money. Mm. Like everyone understands money, and money takes precedence no matter what we do with our time, right? Like, mm-hmm, think of how much time we all give to our workday and we all give to work and how much that actually adds up of our lives.
Yeah.
And it's all to maximize money. We don't really do a lot of things to maximize time,
yeah,
I would say. And even the people who do try to sell you things to help maximize time, i.e. like supplements to help prolong your life or medications to help prolong your life, in turn, they don't actually have good motives either. Yeah. Like I feel like the entire pharmaceutical industry, going back to Rockefeller, they've sold us so many drugs and worked to sell us so many drugs to help us maximize our time, but they don't have good motives. And in turn, there's a lot of downsides to taking those drugs.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, what is the time that you're maximizing? Is it a full life or is it a half life?
And it's a fake life. That's what it is.
And to me, it's like, okay, we're so disconnected from basic understanding of food. Even I feel so, I try to eat relatively healthy, but I'm so disconnected from it. Like there's so many things that I'm still learning about.
Cause
like,
we were sold the food pyramid,
yes,
and it corrupted our minds. And we thought we had to have all these different
roll ups, and
we were told simple things like eat things that are really colorful. And so then when we had fruit snacks, we were like, oh, this is good. It's healthy. They're shaped like carrots and apples. Like perfect. It's just straight sugar. And the food pyramid, as we know, we've talked about this before. We'll link a video to the food pyramid clip that we have. But, I mean, it has just ruined. I mean, the obesity rate right now is like almost 40% of all America.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, we have fast food, so you can get food fast and cheap, and that you don't have to like grow your own food. You don't have to know where your food's coming from, or at a bare minimum, like go to the grocery store and try to navigate getting food. But even like some produce that isn't like directly from like a farm or something, like or a farmer's market or something like that, like people, we dye some of our vegetables and fruit different colors to make it, yeah, look like more normal. Like there's a lot of weird stuff that we even do to our produce. So it's just, it's not even as simple as
carrots aren't actually orange.
Yeah.
That's one example.
GMOs.
And never buy the carrots in the bags with, I've learned this recently, with the liquid inside of them.
Oh gosh.
Because it's got a chemical in it that maintains that oranginess,
oh,
so that it doesn't get, you know, drained out or like soaked,
yeah,
out. So yeah, there's all of these things that you would never think of. And yes, it's so hard to find this information.
Yes.
Like Google will censor it from you.
Yes. Or just to think of it. Like when you see carrots at the grocery store, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm being healthy, you know? And mm-hmm. even if you like eat the carrots without ranch, which like a lot of people just eat with the ranch and they think that's healthy. But then if you don't eat with the ranch, it's like, gosh, they're still not healthy because they have this weird chemical water in it.
What is ranch? Does anybody know what ranch is? I actually have asked people this and nobody knows. Do you know?
And for example, I don't know, but I thought.
What is it?
I thought that Chick-fil-A was like an okay, if you're going to get fast food, get Chick-fil-A. Like the chicken is like good quality. And I find out like there's all these dyes in the chicken.
Yeah.
And my heart's just broken a little bit because I feel stressed.
I've heard they cook with peanut oil too, which yes. isn't the best. Yes, oh my
gosh, canola oil. I didn't know till like 6 months ago how bad canola oil was.
It's horrible, yeah.
And it's in everything.
Seed oils are awful, and it's literally in everything, yeah.
And
vitamin C packets, pretty much every vitamin C, like Emergency, the powder, or like Liquid IV, the powder, or even like vitamin C pills. Not even just gummies, like anything vitamin C. It is so hard to find a real vitamin C supplement because all of them are made with a synthetic called ascorbic acid, which literally destroys your stomach lining. So it like ruins your gut health. And so many years I thought that Emergency was helping me. It was immune system boosting. And I'm sure all of these vitamin C manufacturers through the pandemic were selling so many products because everyone was like, oh, I need to boost my immune system. I need to fight COVID. But in turn, they're destroying their gut, healthy gut bacteria and gut health, mm-hmm. which does more to weaken your immune system than probably getting COVID.
Which again,
so rip to that.
Again, money versus time. Yeah, maybe you'll save some time on the front end, not knowing this stuff, not researching it, whatever. But it will cost you both money and time because then you're going to be stuck on pharmaceutical drugs. You're going to have to go to the gym more to like work off the weight if you mm-hmm. don't want the weight. You're going to have to pay for a gym membership. You're going to have to pay for pharmaceuticals. You're going to have to pay for your doctor. You're going to have to pay, like spend time going to the doctor's office. I mean, there's a lot of like old people that like their entire schedule is just them going to different doctor's appointments.
No, I don't want to be. I don't want to be like that as an adult.
This is the American dream. The American dream is that like you work your whole life to. And I'm not against working. I love work. I've loved the companies that I've worked for. I've gained so much experience.
Purpose.
I find so much purpose in my work. Yeah. And I understand that not everyone can have a job that gives them purpose. I understand that some people just have to make money because they have to make money. But we don't value like our time and like just holistically thinking about things. And I don't think that our institutions care either. And I think that they want us to be in this model where we're just so focused on milestones and achieving them at the right age and pining away for that and following this guidebook that we just never question why we're doing things and even if these things are working.
Yeah, yeah. And allowing the societal, social, for sure, social punishments to happen to people who hit those milestones outside of those time set out time brackets. Mm-hmm. Like there's social punishments to people who like say they graduate high school early mm-hmm. and like get into college earlier than 18 years old, which is when most people go. Mm-hmm. And so then they are looked at weirdly and like there's just a lot of downsides that we've created.
Or if you graduate college early, people look at you weirdly. Mm-hmm. Or that you've
switched jobs too many times. That means you're unreliable. Oh, maybe I'm just like experimenting. Like that's kind of the best way to do it.
Yeah. Or, well, I think the biggest thing is that we're stuck in this, to really break it down, we're stuck in this mindset of having to constantly produce without thinking like why we're producing. We're trying to achieve these things. And for a while, it was working. It was working to get a college education, and that paid off, and you made a lot of money. Like when my mom went to law school, it was only a few thousand dollars a semester, and that was back in the 90s. And now to go to law school, it's what, 60 grand a year, if not more. I mean, that's how much undergrad costs. So it's a lot bigger of an investment. Is your salary that much more? No, I don't think so. I don't think salaries have gone up as much as like college tuition has, but there's more people going to college than there was in the 90s. So that to me is a broken system. Another broken system is the fact that because you now have made a bigger investment in college, you don't get paid more. Mm-hmm. So that's a broken system to me.
There's no reward.
There's a supply chain issue of housing. And instead of the government, you know, like in Los Angeles, for example, taking away regulations so that we can have affordable housing, and not just like inhumane affordable housing, but also things that incorporate landscape and that are really human focused, you know. There's this like building in Santa Barbara, for Santa Barbara University, and this 97-year-old billionaire has donated all this money for it to happen. And all the bedrooms are in the middle of the building, so they don't have any windows.
No natural light.
No natural light in the bedrooms.
That's so like jail.
It's like jail. And this is what, UC Santa Barbara, a college that's right on the ocean and should be the most embracive of natural light.
Yeah, yeah. No, they could literally have like a treehouse dormitory and have like the most beautiful view.
Yeah.
Instead, they're confined and have no access.
And do you think that the cost of that is going to go down, of how much you're going to have to pay in dorm fees?
No, it's probably going to go up.
Exactly. So we keep putting our money into these things that are less quality. And in the meantime, we're becoming more specific. We're trusting our institutions more, and we're becoming more sick because we're trying to save time, because we're trying to save time by like quickly buying food without thinking about it. We're trying to save time by quickly getting medicine without thinking about it.
Yeah, or also working too hard. We're trying to save time by working really, really, really hard in a short period of time, which then can deplete your health drastically.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that either.
Yeah.
So like there's a balance of all of these things. I think that time, money, health.
Yeah. And knowledge.
Or I guess time and health are pretty equivalent.
Yeah.
And then what was the one you said? And knowledge. Yeah. Like these are like the four things at play that clearly our founding fathers knew when they created this American dream. But I don't know if they would look at our American dream right now and think that it matches up with what they initially thought.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing is they were like, we will not sacrifice freedom for comfort. And every day, I think we make small decisions to sacrifice freedom for comfort. And I think that through COVID, that really fast-tracked, and we really saw that. But we've been doing this for years and for decades.
Totally.
And we get stuck in this stupid political like right versus left that doesn't accomplish anything. Nothing is getting improved. And meanwhile, we're putting it on all these politicians to solve our problems, when really like it comes down to every individual, especially our generation that is moving into this world and is going to be the stewards of the world that we're inhabiting for at least a little bit of time, and really reflecting like, what are my values and how do I create a life for myself that allows me to prioritize those values and put those as the goalposts, as opposed to
not money being the driving factor, or values being the driving
achievement
factor,
or or set milestones, and really creating like an individualized path for you. Because when everything is more individualized, you're going to be more happy, because we all are so different in our preferences.
Yeah. And skill sets.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. Just go really briefly going back to the time versus money topic. Mm-hmm. I wrote down some similarities and some differences that I think people might find really interesting. Some of these I actually had never thought of. So here's where they're similar, right? Mm-hmm. Time and money are both currencies, mm-hmm. right? In the sense it's exchanged for other goods,
yeah.
typically, or services. A lot of, you know, you have to give of your time in a work sense. And if mm-hmm. you want someone to do something for you, you might have to give of your time in return. Time and money can both be spent, okay? Time and money both offer some sort of value, and time and money both can be lost. Sad. Yeah, they're both finite, unfortunately. Yeah,
there's only a certain amount.
Unless they're the universe and you're infinite.
Yeah.
That we know of, that we think the universe might be infinite. It's always expanding. Yeah. We'll see. Here's their difference, though. The way you spend your time is much more valuable than the way you spend your money. Right? Mm-hmm. And you know why that is?
Why?
Because money can be recovered, time can't. Let's say you make a bad investment and spend a lot of money on something you realize is a bad investment. You can work hard, give of your time to make more money.
Yeah.
But in the pursuit of that, you lose your time.
Yeah.
So
you're not going to get the time back.
Yeah, you're not going to get the time back. And that's why I think that whole outline just is the key argument to why time, as it's directly correlated to health, is more important than money.
Yeah. What do you think are some examples of us kind of having this awakening of maybe I don't want this manufactured fake America dream. Maybe I want another American dream that's more personalized to me. What do you think are some examples of that that we're living through right now, like post-COVID?
Just where I've witnessed culture moving towards.
Like do you want to talk about the Great Resignation, for example?
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh, you guys, everybody's quitting their jobs. And I do think that there's two camps in that group, yeah. in this Great Resignation. One is I think that there are a lot of people quitting their jobs solely because they are able to access and utilize like government support, you know, yeah. government assistance. Like I think that a lot of people had stimulus check hangovers, mm-hmm. feeling so excited getting these like stimulus checks in the mail during mm-hmm. the pandemic, and then realizing that it wasn't a routine occurrence, and yeah. that in order to get more money from the government, they had to uproot their lifestyles and file for unemployment and go through that whole process. So I do think that there's a camp of people that have genuinely become anti-work solely mm-hmm. to just live off of that and then do whatever else they want to do with their time. But I also do think that there's a lot of people quitting their corporate jobs to enter a more decentralized and sort of self-made sort of
camp
work.
Yeah.
You know, situation, whether that's freelancing or starting their own business, becoming an entrepreneur. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people that are doing that. And, or there's a middle ground of like being able to find corporate America that isn't suffocating mm-hmm. and that isn't going to latch on to all of the new blood that it brings in and keep them sucked in. Mm-hmm. That knows that they're not just an object that they're employing, but like a real person that has needs and all these yeah. things. So I think that those are the different categories within the Great Resignation. But yeah, I mean,
a lot of moms too that just don't want to work anymore because mm-hmm. like they got used to their kids being home with the online school, and then they saw what the kids were being taught, and they're like, "I don't
screw
like
it.
This." You know, like I think there's been a shift with just how families are structured. And then, yeah, I think the other two camps that you brought up are super important. It seems like a lot of people have become Airbnb hosts. Mm-hmm. That seems to be like a big trend on TikTok. It seems like a lot of people are wanting to live with less stuff. You're seeing like a lot of trends with people like being campers or like
minimalism
is becoming like a thing. So I think there's a lot of different trends. I think that people were like so awakened by all the different variations your life could have if you weren't like in a set routine, that it did make people reevaluate. And the people that did were able to have the luxury to quit their jobs did. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a bad thing for jobs to have to, for the market to kind of readjust and have that supply and demand kind of be reassessed and people get paid more and stuff like that. The problem is that we've shipped so much overseas, especially like low like skilled labor overseas. And now we've gotten used to such like cheap products that's going to be tough. People that might not be able to have another skill set that allows them to like freelance or take advantage of like the gig economy or be able to, you know, do something more creative. Like there is that population of the public that like, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. You know? And yeah. This is something that isn't just new from COVID, but has been happening for the past 20 years, and which was a huge reason why Trump got elected, was because of like middle America that was just fed up with living in these cities like Detroit, where entire industries were just taken from them mm-hmm. overseas. And mm-hmm. so I don't know. I think it's a lot of different things.
Well, think of how many obscure and unorthodox ways there are right now to make money. I mean, everybody has like, no one. I mean, if you have just one stream of income, I don't know. It's like,
I feel guilty when you only have one. Like I get nervous when yeah. I like only have one.
Especially if you're in our generation, like anyone with in Gen Z that understands technology more and better than older generations and how right easy now.
It is to make money.
Like there are a million ways that you can make a quick buck.
Yeah.
And have like passive income too.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot. And so if you only have one orthodox stream of income, living paycheck to paycheck, like I don't know if you're maximizing possibilities.
What do you think have been the best ways you have found or that you've heard from people?
Well, honestly, I started experimenting with freelancing since I was like 14, 15 in high school, because I figured out websites where I could just submit proposals to like freelance gigs, mm-hmm. like design and data gigs. And I would just get them and do it and like submit my product and like track my hours, or most of the time it was like project based. And then it's a one and done and you go to the next one.
Yeah.
And so it's totally up to like your schedule, mm-hmm. how that fits with you, when you want to do the work, when you can have that deliverable to them, and you're in complete control. So it's not you having to like report to somebody and you know, have instructions on an assignment. Like you're in the pursuit from your own will and drive and all of that. So
yeah,
that was like an example of something that I did and still do on the side. Mm-hmm. But there's so many ways. Like you can be a drop shipper. You can drive for Postmates. You can
advertise on Pinterest. Like you can like copy and paste advertisements. One thing I saw that's crazy, and I don't know like how legit this is or if only a few people could do this, but there was someone on TikTok saying that how they make money is they take footage of like the ocean and they put like an ocean sound to it, and they just have a YouTube channel of all that.
Whoa.
Or like people make a lot of money off of fireplace YouTube videos with Christmas music in the background.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Because people put that on their TVs. So like a lot of people like monetize that, and they'll make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you can be, as a photographer, you can take stock photography and sell your stock photos on stock mm-hmm. photography websites. Yeah. You can create, you know, those templates that people will download for PowerPoint presentations or whatever. You can like be the one to design and create those presentations and sell them. Same with like copy. You can be a content writer. You can write people's speeches. You could even go and write, you know, a high school freshman's essay that they might need for an English paper, if, like, you've read a book on it or whatever. There's so many things. You can freelance
writing to different article, like different publishing groups online.
Yeah, you can sell ads on your own website. If you built a website and have like a blog or whatever, you can integrate Google Ads and get paid for how many clicks go to that page.
Have you done that on your website?
No, only because I just don't want to clutter it. Yeah. I mean, ideally.
But it's an option. But if you did get eventually enough traction, like, it would make sense to do that.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's how traditional blogs and traditional sites were able to make money from day one, because Google has offered like ad integration from, you know, like, since web was 1.0, like in the 90s.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think overall it's an exciting time to be alive. I think anytime that there's a lot of shift, a lot of times people want to be like, oh, this is scary, I don't know how to navigate it. But I do feel excited, because I feel like Jordan and I are in this weird time where we've got the last benefit of institutional experience. I feel like we were maybe one of the last few generations were like truly getting that full college experience might have been worth it, at least in my opinion. But we're also in this huge experimental period where so much is shifting, so much knowledge is just here, like on the internet, that we have access to, all those ways that you brought up to make income. There's just a lot of room for experimentation. And
the pro to us losing trust in institutions and moving away from institutions is that we're going back to the more intimate exchange of information and trying to reestablish trust within our small networks and communities, so that we can bring that more on the ground and in a smaller distance of transmission, as opposed to from all of these chains of hierarchies
all the way down,
getting down to us.
Yeah.
Clearly, from example, that everybody isn't trusting these institutions anymore. Clearly, they have failed at getting us the information that we need. Mm. And we're finding holes and gaps, a lot of holes and gaps in that process, which is why we're bringing it to the more intimate level. And I'm happy about that.
Yeah, me too.
So, or at least it, from our personal life experience, I think that that's what we're looking towards more.
It's better to be, awake to it now than be the fool later. So I think I'd rather know that I can't trust certain things now and know that I might have to do a little bit extra work than be like confused later on when I realized I've been lied to for decades. So.
Decades, yeah. Well, that's pretty much it. That's all we got for you guys this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, check out our Kickstarter and look at the links in the description of this video and description. We've got the link to the Kickstarter and then also our website if you want to get an Inspired journal. Pick those up. They're cool. And it's good to write on paper. It gets you in tune with your body. And
Google doesn't read this.
And big tech can't delete your thoughts. Yes. So,
well, thank you guys. Like, subscribe, share this video, and we'll catch you next week. So, yeah.
Thank you.